Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Losses and gains were had this week as we lost one of the great poets and a national treasure, Lawrence Ferlin Getty, who died at his home in San Francisco at the age of 101. He was, for a time, the poet laureate of San Francisco, the first to hold that title, and we have a recording of him reading some of his poetry at the San Francisco Public Library on the occasion of his being presented with that distinction. We also have some breaking developments in a story we've been following closely here on the show, the fight to save Oak Flat in Arizona from being destroyed by a giant copper mine. We'll play a news report from the Arizona ABC affiliate in Phoenix from just a few weeks ago when it appeared imminent that the land would be transferred to a foreign-owned copper mining company that has a fairly poor record of compliance with environmental regulations and protections of sacred sites, which the various Apache and Diné tribes in Arizona consider Oak Flat to be. The U.S. Forestry Service had released an environmental impact statement that opponents say minimizes the true damage the mine would have caused, and the release of that report was the final hurdle in activating the land transfer to the Rio Tinto Resolution Copper Mining Company. But just last week, the Biden administration stepped in, ordering the Forest Service to withdraw the environmental impact statement altogether. That resets the situation to the point before the study was released, and we can presume that the Forest Service is now beginning to revise that report, but that if historical patterns hold, the new report, which could be released within months or weeks, would still greenlight the mine.
Drive an hour east of Phoenix, and you will find one of Arizona's unique and beautiful landscapes in the Tonto National Forest. It is an area known for its campgrounds, trails, and rock climbing, and also for its valuable mineral resources. A mining giant is finishing up plans to dig under part of the area named Oak Flat, a sacred place for Native Americans. ABC 15's Claudia Rupcich and photojournalist Danny Bavaro spent several days there for this in-depth report on the conflicts over beauty, religion, and money.
The process would take several years, but this copper mine would essentially destroy Oak Flat and some of the surrounding areas. This is land where Native Americans once lived freely before they were sent to reservations. Now it's national forest, and even though an international company is one step closer to owning it, Native Americans and the allies that have been fighting this project say they won't give up now.
Oak Flat is about an hour east of Phoenix. It's off Route 60 by the town of Superior in Pinal County. Part of the Tonto National Forest, Oak Flat is known for its stunning scenery, world-renowned rock climbing, and popular campground. For some Native tribes, it's culturally important. For Apaches, this land is holy.
It's our identity, it's our culture, it's our way.
It's why for years, people have been fighting plans to build an underground copper mine at Oak Flat. Resolution Copper is owned by British Australian companies Rio Tinto and BHP. They'll capture the copper ore with explosives coming at it from underneath the deposit 7,000 feet below the surface. As the explosions undercut the copper ore, the land will collapse into a giant sinkhole, leaving a crater nearly 2 miles wide. The Resolution Copper project would be among the largest mines in the United States, estimated to produce as much as 40 billion pounds over 40 years. Oak Flat would be destroyed.
And that's what this fight is about. Is about survival. You know, without these places, our people won't survive spiritually.
For generations, the Nosey family from the San Carlos Apache tribe has been taking part in traditions at Oak Flat.
Since I was a little girl, my grandma, my mom took me here, and we would pick the acorn, and we use that as, we say, like, our Apache cuisine. You know, we put it in our soups and in our meats.
Those emery oak groves would also be destroyed.
Here's a little bit more. Fresh one, Cheche Begoste. The Apache name of this place, that's where it comes from. During the day, it was 100 and something degrees, I just stayed here.
Winsler Nosey Sr. created Apache Stronghold years ago, a group of tribe members, locals, and others fighting to protect sacred sites. He's the former chairman of the San Carlos Apache tribe and served many years as city council member there. He's been living at Oak Flat for the past year.
It includes everything from angels, you know, to the earth talking to you, the wind talks to you.
and just the holiness of this place.
For Apache people in the past, you could be born here and you could die here. So everything here that is provided for us, the water from the springs, the animals and the plants, that's something sacred.
Nosy Senior says Oak Flat is at the center of their teachings about life and creation and their connection to Mother Earth.
You know, we talk about angels, you know, these deities, you know, the spirit, the gift of life.
The Apaches and other Native Americans have used this land to pray, collect medicinal plants, hold ceremonies, and honor those buried there. If the mine goes forward as planned, it will consume those burial sites, ruins, and petroglyphs.
Behind here, you have a lot of petroglyphs, but they've been vandalized.
Nolan Pike says Oak Flat has been the site for many sunrise ceremonies, a rite of passage for women. She explains that in the Apache religion, there's an eternal direct connection between the girl and the land where the ceremony took place.
From the air to the water is sacred and holy. It's that direct connection to our Creator.
She worries her youngest sister and future children won't get to share in these traditions.
How do I even tell someone, like, son or daughter, like, this place was beautiful, and now you're looking at a crater.
Impact reports by the U.S. Forest Service warn waste from the mine could contaminate water supplies, potentially threatening wildlife habitats, wells, and water for livestock.
It's a travesty that should not be allowed to occur.
Randy Saraglio is a Southwest conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. He says the Resolution Copper Project would devastate the landscape and endangered animals and plants.
They have to dewater that hole in order to do their operation. So many springs and creeks in the area will go dry and destroy habitat that's absolutely essential for so many species.
That includes Gone, or Devil's Canyon, just east of the proposed project. With spectacular rock formations, pools, and a waterfall, it's a gem for hikers and rock climbers.
It's just a travesty that, you know, we've got nothing in our federal laws that can protect places like this.
This area had been protected for decades, but a bill in 2014 authorized an exchange of land that would give Resolution Copper 2,400 acres in Oak Flat.
Leaders at Resolution Copper say they have consulted with tribes about how to best protect what's sacred to them. The company also says this project would bring thousands of jobs to this area of the Copper Triangle. In our next piece, we'll bring you voices from those who support the mine. I'm Claudia Rupsich, ABC 15 Arizona.
And you'll be able to catch that next part of the story tomorrow night. The story also continues online with exclusive content you'll find only on ABC15.com.
What that news report left out, of course, was that there is a bill before the Congress called the Save Oak Flat Act, introduced by Tucson Congressperson Raul Grijalva, that would rescind the land swap and protect Oak Flat indefinitely. Proponents of that bill urge you to call your congresspeople and senators to support that bill as it gets to both houses. Lawrence Ferland Getty was a beat poet who was part of the West Coast cadre that included Gary Snyder, Jack Cassidy, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and the like. His poems have been popularized in many forums, including the original Woodstock concert and the last performance of the band, but his best-known accomplishment was the founding of the Progressive City Lights bookstore, which remains open today.
I see the mayor got a little extra Seoul in Seoul, Korea, and appointed me mayor. Appointed me. Let that one go. Inasmuch as I'm in competition with the league championship, the Yankees versus the Indians, I've got to read my baseball canto. From another era, as you'll see. Watching baseball, sitting in the sun, eating popcorn, reading Ezra Pound, and wishing Juan Marichal would hit a hole right through the Anglo-Saxon tradition in the first canto and demolish the barbarian invaders from Los Angeles. When the San Francisco Giants take the field and everybody stands up to the national anthem with some Irish tenor's voice piped over the loudspeakers, with all the players struck dead in their places and the white umpires like Irish cops in their black suits and little black caps pressed over their hearts, standing straight and still like at some funeral of a Blarney bartender. And all facing east as if expecting some great white hope or the founding fathers to appear on the horizon. But Willie Mays appears instead in the bottom of the first, and a roar goes up as he clouts the first one into the sun and takes off like a foot runner from Thebes. The ball is lost in the sun and maidens wail after him, but he keeps running through the Anglo-Saxon epic. And Tito Fuentes comes up looking like a bullfighter in his tight pants and small pointed shoes. And the right field bleachers go mad with Chicanos and blacks and Brooklyn beer drinkers. Sweet Tito, sock it to him, sweet Tito. And sweet Tito puts his foot in the bucket and smacks one that don't come back at all. And flees around the bases like he's escaping from the United Fruit Company. As the gringo dollar beats out the pound. And sweet Tito beats it out like he's beating out usury, not to mention fascism and anti-Semitism. And Juan Marichal comes up, and the Chicano bleachers go loco again as Juan belts the first fastball out of sight and rounds first and keeps going and rounds second and rounds third and keeps going and hits pay dirt to the roars of the grungy populace. As some nut presses the backstage panic button for the tape-recorded national anthem again to save the situation. But it don't stop nobody this time in their revolution round the loaded white bases. In this last of the great Anglo-Saxon epics in the Territorio Libre of baseball. And now comes the hard part of the performance, reading prose. Poetry and City Culture. I certainly was surprised to be named Poet Laureate of this far-out city on the left side of the world. And I gratefully accept, for as I told the mayor, how could I refuse? I'd rather be Poet Laureate of San Francisco than anywhere, because this city has always been a poetic center, a frontier for free poetic life, with perhaps more poets and more poetry readers than any place in the world, than any city in the world. But we are in danger of losing it. In fact, we are in danger of losing much more than that. All that made this city so unique in the first place seems to be going down the tube at an alarming rate. This week's Bay Guardian has the results of a survey that, quote, reveals a city undergoing a radical transformation from a diverse metropolis that welcomed immigrants and refugees from around the world to a homogeneous, wealthy enclave. The Bay Guardian's issue this week is really extraordinary. For a four-month survey in detail of what I'm talking about, showing a transformation from a diverse metropolis that welcomed immigrants and refugees from around the world to a homogeneous, wealthy enclave. The gap between the rich and the poor in San Francisco increased more than 40% in 2 years recently. San Francisco may soon become the first fully gentrified city in America, the urban equivalent of a gated bedroom community, says Daniel Zoll in The Guardian. Now it's becoming almost impossible for a lot of the people who have made this such a world-class city, people who have been the heart and soul of the city for decades, from the fishers and pasta makers and blue-collar workers to the jazz musicians to the beat poets to the hippies to the punks and so many others, to exist here anymore. And when you've lost that part of the city, you've lost San Francisco, unquote. And Richard Walker, head of geography at UC Berkeley, said, it means a one-dimensional city, a more conservative city, one that will no longer be a font of social innovation and rebellion from below. Just another American city, a corporate city, a fate it has resisted for generations, unquote. When I arrived in the city in 1950, I came overland by train and took the ferry from the Oakland Mole to the ferry building, and San Francisco looked like some Mediterranean port, a small white city with mostly white buildings, a little like Tunis, seen from seaward. I thought perhaps it was Atlantis, risen from the sea. I certainly saw North Beach, especially, as a poetic place, as poetic as some quartiers or neighborhoods in Paris, as poetic as any place in old Europa, as poetic as any place where great poets and painters had found inspiration. And this was the first poem I wrote here, a North Beach scene. Away above a harbor full of caulkless houses, among the Charlie Noble chimney pots of a rooftop rigged with clotheslines, a woman paces up sails upon the wind, hanging out her morning sheets with wooden pins. Oh, lovely mammal, her nearly naked breasts throw taut shadows as she stretches up to hang at last the last of her so whitewashed sins. But it is wetly amorous and winds itself about her, clinging to her skin. So caught with arms upraised, she tosses back her head in voiceless laughter, and in choiceless gesture then shakes out gold hair. While in the reachless seascape spaces between the blown white shrouds stand out the bright steamers to kingdom come. But this past weekend, North Beach looked like a theme park, literally overrun by tourists, and kitsch was king. We won't mention the destruction of the old U.S. restaurant. It's a tragedy. What happened to North Beach, just as an example of one neighborhood? What makes for a free poetic life? What destroys the poetry of a city? Automobiles destroy it, and they destroy more than the poetry. All over America, all over Europe, in fact, cities and towns are under assault by the automobile. They are literally being destroyed by car culture. Cities are gradually learning they don't have to let it happen to them. Witness our beautiful new Embarcadero. We tried for years to get it torn down, and we always lost in the election. Finally, the earthquake did it for us. And And in San Francisco right now, we have another chance to stop Autogeddon from happening here. Just a few blocks from here, the ugly Central Freeway can be brought down for good if you vote for Proposition E on the November ballot. And for another destroyer of poetry and peace, how about those killing machines, the Navy's Blue Angels? Who have just carried out their annual attack on the city. But the poetic life requires peace, not war. The poetic life of the city, our subjective life, that is, the subjective life of the individual is constantly under attack by all the forces of materialist civilization, by all the forces of our military-industrial perplex, and we don't need these warplanes designed to kill and ludicrously misnamed the Blue Angels. They dive upon our city every year in a frightening militarist and nationalist display of pure male testosterone. I've seen old Vietnam ladies in Washington Square diving under the benches. Do we really need to be reminded yearly how our planes have bombed third world countries back to the Stone Age? In San Francisco, of all places, do we really need, quote, bombs bursting in air to prove that our flag is still there? What would St. Francis say? Perhaps the city could disinvite them this next year. I could go on until I'm singing to your snores, but I'll mention just one more destroyer, chain stores or chain gangs. As the Bay Guardian call them. Corporate chain stores wipe out long-established independence, killing off local color, local traditions, and in the cases of bookstores, literary history. I've been to other great cities on poetry tours and found not a single independent bookstore left in neighborhoods where chain gangs have moved in. It's an old story by now, but it's time to revise a lot of old stories. If so much of this city's population doesn't want chain stores, as the Bay Guardian suggests, why can't the city government take a united stand against them? But to get to the positive side of things, I have quite a wish list for the city. I propose that North Beach, with its long literary history, including Mark Twain, Jack London, Ina Coolbrith, William Saroyan, and many others, including the beat writers, be officially protected as a historic district in the manner of the French Quarter in New Orleans. And thus shielded from commercial destruction, such as was suffered by the classical Montgomery Block building, the most famous literary and artistic structure in the West, until it was replaced by the Transamerica Pyramid. I do hope someone will pick up this ball and run with it. And I propose that a small wooden house on Treasure Island or in the Presidio be made a poet's cottage, where future laureates might live or work and conduct poetry events or even an annual city poetry festival. The mayor and the important poetry journal Poetry Flash are already behind it, So I hope it will happen. And since we're in the main library, let's remember that the center of literate culture in cities has always centered in the great libraries as well as in the independent bookstores. This library should have $10 million a year to spend on books, more than twice as much as presently allotted. It also needs more space already, since evidently this new state of the computer postmodern masterpiece doesn't have as much shelf space as the old library next door. And I believe the people made a great mistake in passing the proposition to remove the old library building from the library system. It might not be too late to reclaim it as a library annex, even though the granite signs on the front of it have already been changed. Even though the proposition to get rid of it has already been partially implemented. All it would take would be another proposition on the ballot to reverse the old library building being taken out of the library system. Maybe someone would like to mount a proposition the next time around. Other outrageous things on my wish list include, one, give bicycles and pedestrians absolute priority over automobiles. Give absolute priority to bicycles, particularly over automobiles, and close much of the original inner city to cars completely. Including Upper Grand Avenue, which we tried to do years ago. Two, make the city a center for low-power alternative radio and TV with tax breaks for the broadcasters. Three, uncover our city's creeks and rivers again and open up the riparian corridors to the bay. Five, paint the Golden Gate Bridge golden. Really disappointed when I came out here. It's painted red lead, and I had enough of that in the Navy. Finally, number six, tilt Coy Tower. Think what it did for Pisa. Just a half an inch, that's all I'm asking. Where's Galileo? And speaking of the literary culture of the city, finally, I'd like to announce that City Lights is just now attempting to create a nonprofit foundation so that City Lights may continue through the next century as a literary center and poetic presence in the city. For such a foundation, we need help. Philanthropic literary angels are invited to descend upon us.
Mama's not blue.
Poets, come out of your closets. Open your windows, open your doors. You have been holed up too long in your closed worlds. No time now for the artist to hide above, beyond, behind the scenes, indifferent, paring his fingernails, refining himself out of existence. No time now for our little literary games, for our paranoias and hypochondrias. No time now for fear and loathing. Time now only for light and love. We have seen the best minds of our generation destroyed by boredom at poetry readings. Etc. This is the first part of a really long diatribe. Anyway, what I had in mind in this populist manifesto in the 1970s was for poets to stop mumbling in their beards and to private audiences and say something important to the world. A few years ago, I gave a talk in Michael McClure's class at the California College of Arts and Crafts, the title of which was, "Why Don't You Paint Something Important?" There was a graffito on the wall that said, "You're so minimal." Anyway, it was an attempt to pry the artists like the poets out of their hermetic worlds. Parenthetically, I must say that my manifesto called forth such a cacophony of bad poetry that some editors felt like chanting, "Poets, go back in your closets." The manifesto was not a very original Whitmanian call for universal poetry with what I call public surface, a poetry very accessible with a common sensual surface that can be understood by most everyone without a very literary education. But of course, if it was to rise above the level of journalism, it must have other subjective and or subversive levels. Well, I'm still on the same kick. Most poets today still exist in a kind of poetry ghetto. They get pittances to publish poems compared to prose writers, even in mass media, if they manage to get in at all. And poetry readings don't begin to pay the rent for most. What to do about it? How to get poetry out of the poetry ghetto? The answer is obvious. Write poems that say something supremely original and supremely important, which everyone aches to hear. Poetry that cries out to be heard, poetry that's news. And is it naive to think that even the mass media might print it or air it if it were a new kind of news? Perhaps the poets would still be ignorant, be ignored by our dominant culture because they're saying just what our materialist, technophiliac world doesn't want to hear. And the messenger with the unwelcome message will continue to be killed? I would like to propose a regular monthly column in a daily newspaper with the title Poetry is News. It would begin with great poems of the past that still are news. I think right off of Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. "Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." I think also of Whitman's "I Hear America Singing," of poems by Homer, Shakespeare, W.B. Yeats, Cavafy, Pablo Neruda, Marianne Moore, E.E. Cummings, Kenneth Patchen, Kenneth Rexroth, Allen Ginsberg, Adrian Rich. I think of Bob Dylan's early songs and of the Beatles' Yellow Submarine, of the great Paramita Sutra, and perhaps of the latest rap poetry at the New Yorican Cafe on the Lower East Side. And I think of the French poet Jacques Prévert, whom I translated when I was a student in France, two of his, The Discourse on Peace. Near the end of an extremely important discourse, the great man of state, stumbling on a beautiful hollow phrase, falls over it, and undone with gaping mouth, shows his teeth, and the dental decay of his peaceful reasoning exposes the nerve of war, the delicate question of money. Quartier Libre, the free zone. I put my cap in the cage and went out with a bird on my head. So one no longer salutes, asked the commanding officer. No, one no longer salutes, replied the bird. Ah, good. Excuse me, I thought one saluted, said the commanding officer. You are fully excused. Everybody makes mistakes, said the bird. Above and beyond all this, poetic intuition and the intuitions of great poetry still remain our best medium for fathoming man's fate. In this vein, here are a few proposed subjects for poets to ponder. Why is it dark at night? Why is there darkness at night? Is every orgasm a little death or a little birth? Is death male or female or neither? La vida es sueño. Is life literally a dream? And if so, when will we truly awake? And I'll read some more San Francisco poems. They were putting up the statue of St. Francis in front of the Church of St. Francis in the city of San Francisco, in a little side street just off the avenue where no birds sang. And the sun was coming up on time in its usual fashion and just beginning to shine on the statue of St. Francis where no birds sang. And a lot of old Italians were standing all around in the little side street just off the avenue watching the wily workers who were hoisting up the statue with a chain and a crane and other implements. And a lot of young reporters in button-down clothes were taking down the words of one young priest who was propping up the statue with all his arguments. And all the while no birds sang any St. Francis passion, and while the lookers kept looking up at St. Francis with his arms outstretched to the birds which weren't there, a very tall and very purely naked young virgin with very long and very straight straw hair and wearing only a very small bird's nest in a very existential place kept passing through the crowd all the while, and up and down the steps in front of St. Francis, her eyes downcast all the while, and singing to herself. The statue was taken down. Years later, the head priest changed there, and the new one didn't like the statue by Benny Bufano, and it was removed, and it now graces the parking lot at the Longshoremen's Hall down by Fishman's Wharf. Now, this dog really existed. He got kind of notorious in North Beach because, well, you'll see. This dog trots freely in the street and sees reality. And the things he sees are bigger than himself. And the things he sees are his reality. Drunks in doorways, moons on trees. Dog trots freely through the street, and the things he sees are smaller than himself. Fish on newsprint, ants in holes, chickens in Chinatown windows, their heads a block away. The dog trots freely in the street, and the things he smells smell something like himself. The dog trots freely in the street, past puddles and babies, cats and cigars, pool rooms and policemen. He doesn't hate cops. He merely has no use for them. And he goes past them and past the dead cows hung up whole in front of the San Francisco meat market. He would rather eat a tender cow than a tough policeman, though either might do. And he goes past the Romeo Ravioli factory and past Coit's Tower and past Congressman Doyle of the Un-American Committee. He's afraid of Coit's Tower, but he's not afraid of Congressman Doyle. Although what he hears is very discouraging, very depressing, very absurd to a sad young dog like himself, to a serious dog like himself. But he has his own free world to live in, his own fleas to eat. He will not be muzzled. Congressman Doyle is just another fire hydrant to him. The dog trots freely in the street and has his own dog's life to live and to think about and to reflect upon, touching and tasting and testing everything without benefit of perjury. A real realist with a real tale to tell. And a real tale to tell it with. A real live, barking, democratic dog engaged in real free enterprise. With something to say about ontology, something to say about reality and how to see it and how to hear it, with his head cocked sideways at street corners as if he is always just about to have his picture taken for Victor Records, listening for his master's voice and looking like a living question mark into the great gramophone of puzzling existence with its wondrous hollow horn, which always seems just about to spout forth some victorious answer to everything. A show at George Krefsky's art gallery a couple of years ago, and I guess I got this poem out of it. Except it actually goes back to the figurative painters that I knew. I had a studio in 9 Mission Street where Frank Lobdell had a studio and Marty Snipper, and I got my studio from Hassel Smith. And those guys were heavy drinkers and they played jazz. They had big parties and most of them blew some instrument. And the openings in the galleries were falling down affairs. The artist. The party hoppers wolfing down the wine and cheese without a glance at what might be considered art. At all those Thursday evening openings in San Francisco galleries, and the critics and the crickets and the singles out to score, and the docents of the donor classes sheathed in silk and Christian Dior, holding long-stemmed glasses, with the tide of tinkle voices rising, and the painter to one side apprising the whole uprising, as if from a most distant shore, and saying to himself, "Is this what I am painting for?" No wonder, then, that he, adrift in this society, doth drink too much and roll upon the floor. This happens all the time in North Beach. The Green Street Mortuary Marching Band. The Green Street Mortuary Marching Band marches right down Green Street and turns into Columbus Avenue, where all the cafe sitters at the sidewalk cafe tables sit talking and laughing and looking right through it, as if it happened every day in little old wooden North Beach in San Francisco. But at the same time feeling thrilled by the stirring sound of the gallant marching band as if it were celebrating life and never heard of death. And right behind it comes the open hearse with a closed casket, and the big frame picture under glass propped up, showing the patriarch who has just croaked. And now, all 7 members of the Green Street Mortuary Marching Band, with the faded gold braid on their beat-up captain's hats, raise their bent axes and start blowing all more or less together, and Out comes this onward Christian soldiers. Like you heard it once upon a time, only much slower with a dead beat. And now you see all the relatives behind the closed glass windows of the long black cars. And their faces are all shiny, like they've been weeping with washcloths, and all super serious, like as if the bottom has just dropped out of their private markets. And there's the widow in weeds, and the sister with the bent frame, and the mad brother who never got through school, and Uncle Louie with the wig. And there they all are, assembled together and facing each other, maybe for the first time in a long time. But their masks and public faces are all in place as they face outward behind the traveling corpse up ahead. And oompa, oompa goes the band very slow, with the trombones and the tuba and the trumpets and the big bass drum. And the corpse hears nothing. Or everything. And it's a glorious autumn day in old North Beach. If only he could have lived to see it. Only we wouldn't have had the band, who half an hour later can be seen struggling back silent along the sidewalks, looking like a hungover, broken down Irish bartender's dying for a drink or a last hurrah. At the Golden Gate, a single plover far at sea wings across the horizon. A single rower almost out of sight rows his skull into eternity. And I take a Buddha crystal in my hand and begin becoming pure light. I saw one of them sleeping, huddled under cardboard by the Church of St. Francis. I saw one of them rousted by the priest. I saw one of them squatting in bushes. I saw another staggering against the plate glass window of a first-class restaurant. I saw one of them in a phone booth shaking it. I saw one with burlap feet. I saw one in a grocery store come out with a pint. I saw another come out with nothing. I saw another putting a rope through the loops of his pants. I saw one with a bird on his shoulder. I saw one of them singing on the steps of City Hall in the so cool city of love. I saw one of them trying to give a lady cop a hug. I saw another sleeping by the Brooklyn Bridge. I saw another standing by the Golden Gate. The view from there was great. In Golden Gate Park that day, a man and his wife were coming along through the enormous meadow, which was the meadow of the world. He was wearing green suspenders and carrying an old beat-up flute in one hand, while his wife had a bunch of grapes, which she kept handing out individually to various squirrels as if each were a little joke. And then the two of them came on through the enormous meadow, which was the meadow of the world. And then, at a very still spot, where the trees dreamed and seemed to have been waiting through all time for them, they sat down together on the grass without looking at each other and ate oranges without looking at each other and put the peels in a basket which they seemed to have brought for that purpose without looking at each other. And then he took his shirt and undershirt off but kept his hat on sideways and without saying anything, fell asleep under it. And his wife just sat there looking at the birds which flew about, calling to each other in the stilly air as if they were questioning existence or trying to recall something forgotten. But then finally, she too lay down flat and just lay there looking up at nothing, yet fingering the old flute which nobody played, and finally looking over at him without any particular expression except a certain awful look of terrible depression. This is a poem I wrote in Prague in May. Prague is a great place these days. Andrei Kudrescu, who is here tonight, he was there this summer. He didn't get the same impression I did. I found it's like the 60s just happened there. And the intellectuals and the artists who were who were all in jail under the dictatorship are now running the cultural scene, and the artists seem to be rushing around full of great ideas and excited. And they haven't had, it's like the 60s just happened, they haven't had time to get cynical and disillusioned the way the French are. I mean, I went to Paris from there, and what a difference. Even the students around the Sorbonne look totally bored. This poem came to me in the middle of the night, so I'll end with this. Rivers of light, my mind is racing in the middle of the night. My mind races through the darkness around the world, through the darkness of the world, toward a tunnel of light. It races through the night of Prague, through Staromak Square, with its Jan Hus sculpture, reading Love Each Other and the Truth Will Triumph. It races on through the night streets, across the Charles Bridge, across the river at the heart of Prague, across the rivers of the world, across the Rhine, across the Rhone, across the Seine, across the Thames, across Atlantic, across Manhattan, across Great Hudson, into the heart of America. My heart is racing now across America, across Old Man River, rolling along. Where is the light? My heart is racing now across terrific Pacific, across the river of yellow light of Sun Yat-sen, across Gandhi's Ganges, across Euphrates, across the Nile, across the Hellespont, across Tiber, across Arno, across Dante's River Styx, through the medieval darkness, into the heart of the tunnel of light. My heart and mind are racing now, together on the same beat, to the same music. It's not the music of Carmina Burano. It's the music of Don Giovanni. It's Mozart's horn concerto. It's the yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. There is a sign in the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm trying to read it. We are all trying to read it. Dark figures dancing it in the half darkness. Light figures dancing it in the half light. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Mr. Ferlinghetti, for a wonderful evening. And let's all go home and write some poetry. Yeah, let's do it. Thank you. Good evening.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the great American poets and an icon of a generation, or two, or three. We'll close the show with some macabre comedy in the raw, a snippet of a truly awful recording from the recent alt-white conservative conference held over the weekend in Orlando. You know, the one where the stage was shaped like a Nazi symbol, and which prompted the Hilton Hotel chain where the event was held to distance and deny any association with the event's theme. And they also featured a golden statue of Donald Trump, their hero and savior, who was also the headline speaker there. Well, the statue may have been golden, but the throat of the person who sang the national anthem there was anything but. I couldn't believe this the first time I heard it. It was put up on YouTube by a musician who set it to the rendition to a kind of a polka background, but the polka music had so many off-kilter chord changes that I presumed the recording had been sped up and slowed down to create those distortions. Well, it turns out it was real. So get ready to chomp down on a towel or something and take a listen.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleam? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight
for
the
ramparts,
it gets worse.
It's like me in a car.
Gave proof through the night that our
confident though.
Yeah.
Was still there.
Ooh.
Jeez.
So say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Land of the free.
Her eyes.
Go get it.
And the home of the brave.
It's like a Rush song.
You know, what's amazing.
Well, this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 FM and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and even I can sing better than that, but I probably won't next week when I join you here again with another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course, please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, the Green Renaissance.